From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm John Donvan, and for Tom Ashbrook, this is On Point. Clean. That's a nice word. Almost means good. Good and clean. That's what we want to be. We're taught it early and endlessly. Soap, toothpaste, mouthwash, deodorant, they're all there to keep us from feeling dirty, which is bad. But are we over-cleansing ourselves? Could germs on the body be beneficial? Some scientists say yes. Welcome, germs. Welcome to an hour of No Soap Radio. This hour on Point, Rethinking Clean and the New Science of Human Skin. Joining me first from San Francisco is Julia Scott, who ran a very interesting experiment and then wrote about it. She went with no soap or shampoo or deodorant for a full month. Instead, she sprayed on daily a mist of water and bacteria. She told her story recently in the New York Times Sunday Magazine. It is called My No Soap, No Shampoo Bacteria-Rich Hygiene Experiment, and you can find a link on our website at onpointradio.org. Julia, welcome to the program.
Thanks so much, John. It's such a pleasure to be here.
It's a pleasure to have you. And actually very, very interested to know what this experience and experiment was like. So how did you come to even know about this mist that you can spray on? Why did you do this experiment?
That's a very good question.
You're still asking yourself.
I heard about it from a fellow journalist, actually, who was friends with one of your other guests today, Jamie Haywood from AO Biome, and knew about the product way before it launched. And when I first interviewed Mr. Haywood and the other folks at AO Biome about their product, I found out they'd all been using it for a long time. One person in particular, the chemical engineer who discovered the product that AO Biome uses, this bacteria called Nitrosomonas eutropha, had not taken a shower or bathed with any kind of soap for 12 years because he was so convinced that the microbial action of this particular bacteria was beneficial to his skin. He didn't want to take any chance that it would be removed after he had found out a way to apply it.
Wow.
So as a journalist, you hear a story like that and you think, well, gosh, you know, I could either write about this, you know, just in a straight, you know, typically journalistic way, or I could actually try it.
You were the test subject then. You made yourself the test subject.
Yes, I persuaded the company to let me become test subject number 26.
Uh-huh.
They didn't need too much persuading because I think they have an ongoing clinical test going for people to tell them, you know, what their product does. And it was my idea to not use soap or shampoo or deodorant for a month because I wanted to cut down on the variables.
Right.
And because I'm a little crazy maybe and wanted to see what would happen. The company does not suggest that people go without their soaps or shampoos. It's for them, AO Plus is more of an additive, but I decided to do something a little bit more extreme.
So just to clarify, two-part experiment. One is the stopping the normal regime of soap and shampoo and deodorant and the other, and that was your variable. That was your introduction to the experiment, your variation. But the main part was to spray on this mist called, just to be clear, because it's a little hard, I think, to hear. It's called AO Plus is the name of this this combination of water and bacteria that comes in a little spray bottle. I'm holding a sample of it in my hand at the moment. And so you went a month without the normal and with the AO Plus. What was the impact of without the normal?
I think, you know, anybody who's gone a few weeks camping without washing will know what happened. My hair became greasy and disgusting. It looked like someone had opened a jar of honey and dumped it on my hair and let it harden. It didn't get any better by virtue of not showering for several weeks. It got worse.
Uh-huh.
My body odor, you know, was something that I actually had gone to great lengths for 33 years to avoid encountering. I'm a thoroughly modern woman. I had grown used to my daily shampoos and showers with many fragrant soaps and body washes. And so for the first time, I went without all of those. And without deodorant, and discovered that my underarms kind of smell like onions. And that was pretty gross. And I made all of my unfortunate friends and family and coworkers smell me and tell me what they thought I smelled like.
Onions from them too?
Onions and also apparently pungent marijuana is is another smell. And then the one time that I went to the gym and sweated it up a little bit, I didn't smell at all, which may speak to what AO Plus says it does, which is it oxidizes the ammonia that your sweat produces.
Daily, tell us about how you apply this stuff. Let me. I have this little bottle of it here, and you just do this little squirt sound like this. I don't know if you can hear that.
I can hear it.
Yeah. I apply it directly to the tongue. Is that correct? No.
No.
Oh, it tastes terrible. No, where do you apply it?
I applied it all over. I applied it on my scalp twice a day. I applied it on my body and everywhere, under my arms, on my feet.
Mm-hmm.
And
the idea then is the bacteria are going to work doing their own process on the chemicals and the compounds on your skin. And you mentioned ammonia, so they're chewing away at the ammonia on your skin. Is the ammonia known to be the source of odor for the most part?
Yes. You know, I'm not a scientist, but I learned that ammonia and urea, when they are produced by sweat, they're exposed to the environment, and that commences the chemical breakdown process that ends up resulting in odor.
Okay.
So I'm sure Mr. Haywood can tell you more about this process, but the ammonia kind of when it breaks down, it doesn't smell as much because...
Well, since you're having a little bit of a talk around on the science, why don't we bring in James Haywood? He is the chairman and co-founder of AO Biome. It's actually researching a lot of products that they hope will use. The term biome refers... Well, I'll ask James. It refers sort of to that other world that lives on our skins and inside our bodies, this population of apparently 100 trillion various kinds of microbes, which is a lot of microbes. James Haywood, welcome to On Point.
Great to be here, John.
So to finish up where Julia was saying, what's the thought behind what the spraying on of the bacteria does to your skin? Once it's there, what does it do?
Well, you know, AOB, which are the ammonia oxidizing bacteria, even sort of in the they're very small portion of your biome. And as you said, you know, the amount of cells that sit on our body or in our body, you know, the biome estimates are anywhere from like 3 to 10 times as many as we have in our own body are sort of these foreign symbiotic or bacteria that are both helping us and sometimes hurting us. And, you know, I think that what's interesting about the theory that David, who's the guy that invented this or discovered this, is that AOB are sort of a pretty small portion, but they can kind of be sort of the regulators. And what they do is they prevent any of the other bacteria from sort of dominating or becoming pathogenic or taking over. And they sort of create diversity. And they do that because, and this is theory, but that because what they do is when they generate nitric oxide, that they prevent the other bacteria from sort of quorum sensing and forming these colonies that are when things become pathogenic or bad. And that sort of keeps a balance in the system. And then the other thing they do is they lower the pH of your skin to, you know, what's healthy, you know, about 5.5. And that and producing a fair amount of nitrate sort of makes a healthy environment that sort of where your skin would like to be if it wasn't distorted by the way we sort of clean and optimize and use products on it. And so I think it's a combination of those things, sort of the regulation that produces an increase in diversity and then the sort of creation of a healthy environment.
We're going to have to take a break, and I want to have you both stay through it. But before we do, Julia Scott, I just want to know, what's your bottom line on the experiment? Once you were done, what did you conclude?
Well, it was interesting, actually. You know, my skin improved a little bit, and I don't know if I can attribute that to the ammonia oxidizing bacteria or the fact that I wasn't using soap on my face for the first time. But in my opinion, the biggest transformation was psychological because, you know, when I started this experiment, the idea of applying bacteria was, you know, was something that, that was utterly foreign to me. Like everybody else, I associate them with bad things. And by the end, I got to the point where I could conceptualize making peace with my resident bacteria and even making friends.
Very nice way to put it. Well, listen, I'd like to have you both stay through the break. And we are talking about the new emerging science on the human body's skin microbiome and our new thinking on what it means to be clean. And you can join the conversation. Where are you on this question? Do you think there's such a thing as being too clean? And are you actually bathing less and bathing the kids less? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. I'm John Donvan, in for Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. When I begin to die, it'll be someone to cry. Night and day, like a bird, you left your robin nest, and just like all the rest, you flew away. A little bit of soul, or will I take away your perfume eventually? But a little bit of soul will never wash away the memory. So we'll never wash away my tears. I'll never lose the memory of your name in the night that I'll call through the lonely years. A little bit of soap we'll never wash away my tears. This is On Point. I'm John Donvan in for Tom Ashbrook. We are rethinking clean this hour, and we're looking at the new science on human skin and the community of germs that live on it, and scientists think must live on it for it to be good for you. Our guests, Julia Scott, her story about her experiment with going unwashed to achieve a new kind of clean appeared in last Sunday's New York Times Magazine. Also joining us from Boston is James Haywood. He is chairman and co-founder of biotech startup AO Biome, which makes the very spray that Julia used for a month. And James, before we move forward, I want to talk with you a little bit more about the science. I just want to know what your bathing habits are now that you've got this product and you're a believer.
Yeah, you know, it's a great question, and Julia just talked for a minute about it, how it changed her psychology. So when I met David, you know, years ago, and he told me about this idea, and I started the sort of process of learning about the science and the due diligence and trying to figure out what to do here, and I was using it. It was amazing how my psychology changed. And, you know, maybe just do a little thought experiment here for a second, which is, imagine nature. Like, just close your eyes for a second and imagine nature. And typically, I think people conjure up an image of a forest or a field or a, you know, a river with a mossy bank, and it feels healthy, right? That feels healthy to me. And then imagine clean, and you close your eyes again, and you typically come up with sort of a white and a sterile environment. And what was interesting to me is that, you know, just like Julia said, like learning to live with these things that are on our skin or in our guts is, I realized that those were incompatible images. That, mm-hmm. that you know, if you sterilize a garden, you know, if you kill everything in a garden, the first thing that grows is weeds. And you know, and so I think, yeah, myself and my whole family has really shifted. You know, at this point, I probably use shampoo 3-4 times a year, and that's it. Mm-hmm. I think I make less greasy hair than Julia does, but and then soaps really limited to really limited quantity. Though what's exciting now is that out of our lab, we're discovering ingredients that don't hurt these bacteria, and so we're now making. I have the first soap here. I got it this week that we're making from those ingredients, and it felt really good.
So let me ask you this: a question about the. How much you're actually claiming here. And I ask this in the context of you're entering a field, you're not FDA regulated, I understand it. You're marketing yourself as a cosmetic because that is a way for a product that doesn't yet have the science behind it to get onto the market. And correct me if I'm wrong about that. So you're out there as a cosmetic. You're talking about the theory you have behind it. A lot of stuff gets put onto the market that has theories and claims that can be crossed into the charlatanish. But you sound like a quite serious man, and we know you to be actually a serious man. How much are you claiming that you know that the science behind this is solid and that what you're talking about is for real?
Sure. That's actually the exact right question. So let's just touch on the regulations for a second here. So everything is regulated. Food is regulated, cosmetics are regulated, and drugs are regulated. And they're all regulated by very specific rules. And, you know, at the beginning of the show, you sort of joked about how do you apply it to your tongue. I mean, as a foodstuff, this is available. I mean, it's generally accepted as safe in Canada. You could eat this, right?
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And what the rules of cosmetic regulations are about, they're not about, you know, sort of weaker or getting on the market. I mean, this is a natural product. The regulations say it can be on the market. What cosmetics regulate are what you can claim. And we have done one study that was a placebo-controlled study in human volunteers, and Julia was the, you know, the 26th of that group. And what we showed in that study, and we only looked at appearance, was that, you know, two things. One is that people had noticed increased smoothness, hydration, tightness, and softness. Those were things we measured. And those all got better, and they got better based on, you know, with an increasing amount based on the amount of AOB you had on your skin. And then the second thing we showed, and this is the important thing about the hypothesis that David Whitlock had, that the inventor, was that there was no AOB on anyone at the beginning of the study, that when you applied it daily, 96% of the subjects had AOB on them, you know, continuously.
Mm-hmm.
And then 7 days after stopping applying it, and still showering but not using soap, so again, we're using water, municipal water supplies, but not soap, that 60% of the subjects still had AOB on their scalp. And then as soon as you put shampoo, you know, which all the subjects did at the end of the study, only 5%, one of the people, had AOB detectable post-shampooing. So, so what we showed was, you know, the more AOB you have, the better your skin looked in an early study.
It's a correlation is what you're showing.
It's a correlation, you know, and we're presenting all this data at a nitric oxide meeting, you know, this month.
But what about at the molecular level? Your theory is that these guys, these little bacteria you're putting on are chewing up the ammonia. You know that for a fact that's happening?
Yeah, that's been established. I mean, these bacteria are used in wastewater treatment. They're used in agriculture. They're used in lots of places. So that the science of that, that the nitrogen cycle is clearly established. What we have shown is on mice, so these are not humans, and it doesn't mean it'll happen on humans, is that diabetic mice with wounds heal 25% faster.
Mm-hmm.
And again, that's being shown at this nitric oxide meeting. And we've also shown, and this is really interesting to me because, you know, people get sort of icky about the sort of concept of bacteria. We've also shown that, we've studied 5 bacteria now, including the ones that cause acne and staph and strep, among, as well as some others, that there's a 50 to 100-fold reduction in the presence of these pathogenic bacteria in vitro. So these are in cellular assays. So when you add ammonia-oxidizing bacteria to a culture that contains those other bacteria, they go down dramatically. And in fact, Julia's own data, as she wrote about in the article, showed that her propionate, which is the acne bacteria, went down over the course of the study and then came up again.
All right. James Haywood, you're chairman and co-founder of biotech startup AOBiome. Thanks so much for joining us today.
Thank you.
Julia, I want to have you stick around, and I want to actually have you listen to something. Here are the sounds from some 1960s-era ads for personal hygiene products. They include Dr. Scholl's foot spray, Listerine, Whisk laundry detergent, Head & Shoulders shampoo.
You may be the last to know you have a foot odor problem.
Bad breath.
But I should
have used Listerine.
Bring around the collar. Bring around the collar.
Bring around the collar.
Good looking girl. Until you looked close.
Dandruff.
Well, we've been taught there are so many ways to be dirty and nasty and grungy. And what's interesting, we actually put together some more modern era hygiene product commercials that sound like this.
80% of germs can be transmitted by hand. And when used daily, Purell Advanced helps reduce your chance of getting sick.
New Dial Frozen Yogurt Body Wash. Wrap your skin in cooling moisture.
Foot odor strong. Odor Eaters is stronger. Now with 30% more odor fighters and all-day wetness control. Odor Eaters. No shoes, no problem.
Well, joining us in this conversation now from Philadelphia is Elizabeth Grice. She's a professor of dermatology at the University of Pennsylvania. She's actually leading a group of scientists who are looking deeply into this new area of research that James Haywood was talking about, the skin microbiome. Elizabeth, thanks so much for joining us and for making the time today.
Hi, thanks for having me.
I'm interested, as you hear those ads, and there was a real distinction. The hard sell of the 60s became somewhat more sophisticated and gentle in the present day. But basically, the message is oh my gosh, we're dirty creatures. And in the 60s, it was, and you don't even know how dirty you are. That's why you don't have any friends. How overstated is the cultural value that if you're not scrubbed clean and sterile, you're setting yourself up for illness as well as social isolation?
Well, I think our concepts of cleanliness and what's clean and what smells good are certainly evolving. And over time, we see this more propensity to wipe ourselves clean of all of our microbes. And as was discussed earlier in the show, we now know that those microbes aren't necessarily harmful. In fact, the majority of them are doing us favors and have functions
The majority are doing us favors then. Most of them are good.
Most of them are good, and most of them probably, or I would say most of them don't have harmful effects on us, and some of them are probably good and actually doing us favors. So there's bacteria that probably benefit from being on us, but we probably don't get a direct benefit from them. However, they don't harm us by being there. And then there's probably bacteria. In fact, there's examples of this that they perform functions that we haven't had to evolve on our own. So there's a reason we evolved with these microbes, and it's seems a little silly that we're now just trying to eradicate them from our bodies.
Is there the notion that there's a delicate balance that is struck in a healthy person, that the battle going on our skin, unseen by our eyes, between those who are good guys and those who are bad guys is constantly being fought, but that there's a good healthful impasse most of the time? An equilibrium?
Yeah, I think that's a concept. I think that's probably the case. There's a few examples of that in the literature as well, such as Staph epidermidis, which is a commensal bacteria, meaning, you know, it doesn't hurt us. It's there. It's part of our normal flora. These commensal bacteria, then, by simply being there, they can block out more pathogenic bacteria, such as Staph aureus, which we know causes infections. And by disturbing that balance, you can set yourself up for then gaining access to or providing access to a more pathogenic type of bacteria, such as Staph aureus.
Do we actually know the identity of the many kinds of microbes that are living on our skin? Are they cataloged and labeled and understood and dissected?
Well, we've begun to do a really good job of cataloging them, and this came several years ago in the past decade in which we've been able to study these microbes without using culture-based approaches, cultures where we have to actually isolate the bacteria. We can now study them using genomic techniques where we sequence their DNA, and using those DNA sequence tags, we can identify the bacteria based on that. So it's a less biased technique, so we can create these more complete, more precise catalogs of the bacteria on our skin and study in more depth what perturbations or treatments, for example, have the effect on the skin. So we're really good at, we're doing a good job of creating these catalogs and describing what's there. I think the next step is to determine what functionally these bacteria are doing. What are the good subset? What are the bad?
And how deep into that forest are we? Are we just at the edges?
So this field of the skin microbiome is playing catch up to the gut microbiome field. And mm-hmm. I think we're starting to touch the surface of functionality there. My lab and certainly other labs around the world are starting to think more deeply about the skin microbiome. And it certainly helps that the public is taking an interest in this, such as we're seeing now, and how especially with the triclosan ban, for example, we're seeing people are becoming more concerned with what's going on our skin.
We're hearing sort of anecdotally that there are more parents who are not washing their kids every day, not giving them the bath every day. If any of you out there are living that way, we'd like to hear from you and hear why, if that's actually the case. But in the meantime, I'd like to go to Carrie, who is calling from Boston. Hi, Carrie. Welcome to On Point.
Hi, John. How are you?
Good. We're great. Thanks.
I am the wife of a pharmacist and a new mother, and I can tell you that for years, anything antimicrobial or antibacterial has been forbidden in our household.
Why?
Because my husband likes to say, when the big bug hits, honey, I want to be the one that survives. I don't want to be the one that has taken a penicillin for every earache and every sniffle. I don't want to take a Z-Pak just because I have a cough. I want to let my immune system do what it's meant to do.
Wow.
And that's now translating to our daughter who's 10 months old who, you know, I don't slather her with Purell, and I certainly don't even bathe her every day.
Well, what I don't mean to get too personal because it's her private life, but as her guardian at this moment, are you willing to share how often you do bathe her?
I every 2 days.
Well, okay. All right. I'm wondering if anybody out there is shocked by that or if that's becoming the norm. Let's go to Lorraine from Spokane, Washington. Hi, Lorraine, you're on Point.
Hello there.
Hi. Tell us what you're thinking. What's your habit?
Well, it's a very interesting conversation, and I've thought about these things for quite a while. I was a caregiver. I've done several occupations where I had to, you know, wash my hands all the time and such. I was a caregiver for 12 years, so, of course, I was among a lot of sick people, and that was necessary, you know, to make sure my hands were very clean when I handled them. But personally, I only shower once or twice a week. I don't use soap. I use baby shampoo on my hair once a week.
Mm-hmm.
I tend to have oily hair. I'm 72.
Mm-hmm.
I do have pet birds, and when I handle them, I make sure my hands are clean because I don't know what can be transmitted to them, but I've never had a sick bird either.
But you're more worried about getting your hands making the bird sick than the birds making your
right,
hands sick.
Right, from things that I've handled that might make them sick.
Hmm.
But I eat a healthy diet. I weigh 112 pounds. I'm 5'7". I'm big boned. I don't, you know, I have some wrinkling in my face. I lived in the desert for quite a while, and I was out in the sun. There was nothing to do when my family was away. I just was laying in the sun, so I've got, you know, some of that.
Oh.
But I've been really, really healthy, and I begin to think about all the people that I live around, and I live in a mobile home park where there's a lot of older folks, and they're, of course, getting heavier, and they've always got lots to talk about their illnesses, and I think, what a shame, you know, but I think I see that they're eating a lot of the wrong things, but they're also talking about, you know, I got to go home, take a shower. I just got out of the shower and
interesting.
All this. And
yeah,
I,
but
I,
it's
shower, I just rinse off.
It really seems to be a life habit. And I want to go back to Julia Scott before we go to the break. And Julia, I'm only going to be able to give you about 25 seconds to say this, but I'm assuming you heard from a lot of people after you wrote about your piece. Is it your sense that the culture is ingrained in the shower, scrub, sterile habit, or do you think there's a shift going on in this regard?
Actually, very much the latter. I've heard from very, very great number of people who have told me that they have unusual bathing habits and now feel hugely validated by my article. Thank you so much, they say to me. I've also heard from people who say, where can I find a list of bacteria-safe cleaning products? So I think that really speaks to a huge shift in our attitude at this point.
It feels as though it's a little bit underground because people might be embarrassed to share what you shared. Our guests this hour are journalist Julia Stone, who went through a whole month without soaps, shampoos, or deodorants and instead covered herself with a special concoction of bacteria. And she lived to write a big story about it in the New York Times. And Elizabeth Grice, she's a professor of dermatology at the University of Pennsylvania, who is doing deep research into the role of skin bacteria in keeping us healthy, even in healing wounds. And I want to go to Judy, who's calling in from Fayston, Vermont. Judy, what do you got to say?
Yes. Hi, everybody. Great program. I think, first of all, that the advertising of antibacterial soaps and so on has convinced people that they really need it. I'm clean. I can't remember the last time I was sick. When I was in Germany, one of my coworkers a while ago said, how do you Americans get so dirty that you have to take a shower every day? I think that it's very important to build up a resistance to getting sick. If I drop a piece of bread on the floor, I don't throw it away. I blow it off and I eat it.
Well, there's a timing rule, apparently, on that, scientifically proven. I think if you count to five and you pick it up in time, you're safe. Otherwise, it's very dangerous.
I don't think I do it that way.
Well, then you're running a big risk, I've got to tell you.
I have to say that I can't remember the last time I was sick. It's
really?
Been decades.
Interesting.
Absolutely decades. I'm never sick.
All right, Judy, thanks very much for your call. I want to go to something by an author named Catherine Ashenberg. She wrote a book in 2007 called The Dirt on Clean, and that was a big take on the social history of cleanliness. Here she was in an interview on Ontario Public TV in where she was talking about our modern attitudes.
A society that teaches you that you're not really safe to be in company when you're 3 or 4 hours away from your last shower, there's something really wrong with that. And that's such a alienation from our own bodies. Yeah, we're supposed to smell as if we're not on this earth. It seems it's better to smell like a cookie.
Smell like a cookie. I want to go back to Elizabeth Grice. She's a professor of dermatology at UPenn. Elizabeth, help us find some sanity on this. The tenor of the conversation so far seems to be leaning very much towards the we're overdoing it. I'm sure there's such a thing as underdoing it too. I mean, after all, the whole public health movement was very much about hygiene and cleanliness of water and bathing and sterilization of medical instruments, et cetera. There's got to be a middle ground here, is there?
Yeah, I believe there's a middle ground. My personal opinion is moderation for everything. I think that, you know, there are uses for antibiotics, for example. There are times when you absolutely need to use antibiotics. And one of the callers, the first caller, I believe, said, you know, her husband wants them to be ready for when the big super bug hits. And that's a case where if you have a life-threatening infection, you should absolutely use antibiotics so that you don't die from that infection. But there's a lot of cases or a lot of situations in our society where antibiotics are prescribed and they're not necessarily needed. For example, for viral infections, an antibiotic isn't even going to touch a cold or viral infection. So, and all this is doing is making these bugs evolve and become resistant so that they can survive without the when there is an antibacterial or an antibiotic present.
We take note of the fact on your point that CNN is reporting this actually last week that Minnesota, I'm reading this from the CNN copy, Minnesota is clamping down on triclosan or triclosan, an ingredient that's used in some toothpastes, cosmetics, and antibacterial soaps and body washes. The governor signed the bill to go into effect January 1st, 2017. He says, in order to prevent the spread of infectious disease and avoidable infections and to promote best practices in sanitation, no person shall offer for retail sale in Minnesota any cleaning product that contains triclosan. It's been in a lot of products for about 3 decades. And there are simply questions about its health effects, with some linkage perhaps established to antibiotic resistance, which is really exactly what you're talking about. It sounds like. And Julia Scott, yeah. I want to go back to you on that. That sounds like a scientific argument for the notion that we're over cleaning ourselves and with an unintended backfire. But are you also familiar with just a sort of a culturally based rebellion, almost an aesthetic rebellion against hyper cleanliness? I mean, have you heard about the no poo movement, which is not what it sounds like? It means no shampoo, no shampoo. You know, the words no poo and movement don't seem to go together. They would seem to be opposites. But the no shampoo movement, which is something that was written about by the station WRIC, that tracked a lot of people who they went to beauty salons and said that, in fact, they're finding more and more of their customers are declining shampoo. And that would seem to be an aesthetic choice.
It could be, or it could be an extension of some of the concerns that callers have expressed, where, you know, we're seeing a shift away from marketing-driven personal health to, you know, one that's based on nature. Whether the people in the no-poo movement are using the stuff on their hair that, that you and I would use is another question. Something that I wasn't able to put in my article for the New York Times, but that I sort of discovered, was there is this whole underground movement all around the world, the no-poo movement, and instead of using shampoo, they have their own concoctions. They use things like baking soda, and they use like an apple cider rinse. They'll put lemon, they'll put honey in their hair, they'll put tea tree oil. And they swear by it. They post photos of themselves with long, luxurious curls.
I'm sorry to interrupt. I have a posting in front of me that we received on Facebook from Thalassa, who writes, there are plenty of alternatives out there, most of which are easy to do yourself. They are cheaper and they are environmentally friendly. I had no idea. So people are cooking up their own brews then.
So it seems probably not the kind of thing that I would do.
Let's go to John from Buffalo, New York. Welcome to On Point, John.
Hello.
Hi.
Hi. I've felt this way for many, many years with no scientific backup. I worked in public schools as a custodian for 18 years, and I was around sick kids, bathrooms, all garbage, all types of the stuff that's bad. And I did not get sick during that period. I mean, I wash once or twice a week. If I'm really filthy, I will wash the dirt off. I don't try and scrub. Mm-hmm. I would just not get sick.
And John, I just want to ask you for clarification. Were you not scrubbing with the notion that you did not want to remove good stuff from you? Did you have a consciousness of good guys being there that you needed to hang around?
Yes.
Oh, interesting.
I absolutely did.
You talk. I will be quiet. You talk.
Oh, I'm sorry. I completely felt that way, that there were good things and there were bad things. And I wasn't educated enough to know the good or the bad. I just knew that if I was too clean, I'd get sick.
Really?
And once I left that job, a year and a half later, I got a flu that I hadn't had, and it knocked me out. I was completely wrecked. And I think that had everything to do with it. And if I have a moment, when my daughter was born, cesarean section, she didn't go through the natural canal and didn't get that biome from her mother. And she was a little sick for a few years and has, you know, she's fine now, but I think not being born natural, like my first daughter, gave her gave her a disadvantage.
Okay, thanks, John. I mean, that's a guess. You're making a guess there, but it's an interesting one, and it rests on an interesting hypothesis. Let's go to Roxanne in Springfield, Illinois. Roxanne, welcome to On Point.
Hi, thank you.
Sure.
I work at a health food store here, and I answer all kinds of questions that people come in with looking for. Alternative deodorants and things like that. And I myself have been deodorant-free for a number of years, and I also only shower when I'm actually dirty. You know, if I've been in the garden for 6 hours or something, that's definitely called for. But in general, I feel like it's really not necessary. And as a teenager growing up in the early 2000s, mm-hmm. I definitely bought into all of the the cosmetic products, the mousse, the conditioners, shampoos, daily showers, all that stuff. And it actually made me a very sick person. It ruined my complexion. It made my hair oily and everything. And I don't have those problems now. And when I talk to people who are trying to make that switch, they often say, oh, you know, you're amazing. How do you do it? But it also comes along with facing our fears about our own personal biome and the smells and feels and all of that comes along with our natural body.
Roxanne, so your coworkers know what your regime is?
They do, and actually I've heard a couple times that certain coworkers that don't understand it will talk about it behind my back and say, oh, does she think that's cute? Or something like that, and that's not the point. And I've also had, by the very same token, I've had my friends say, hey, you know, I don't want to offend you, but I've noticed the way that you smell, and I think that it's actually very, very pleasant.
I was waiting for the adjective there. They like it. Pleasant.
Mm-hmm. Wow. Right. And, I mean, it's unique to me, and everyone has their own smell, and there is something to be said for learning your own smell and what that has to communicate about your own personal ecology.
All right.
If you have really strong ammonia smells, that could be indicative of something else that is amiss in your body.
Thanks very much for your call, Roxanne. Elizabeth Grice, is there an argument for soap?
What
does soap do?
My personal opinion is that there are valuable reasons to use soap. Soap can wash away grime. It can help help prevent transmission of germs. If you wash your hands correctly, that is, and most people don't.
What's the correct hand washing methodology?
Well, you're supposed to sing happy birthday twice or do your ABCs, I believe.
Okay. And what is
soap? But they don't wash long enough.
What does soap actually do? If it's not something that's got an anti-microbe factor in it, what does it do?
It washes away surface germs, surface dead skin, for example. If there's dirt particles on your skin, it doesn't. Mild soaps or soaps that don't contain an antibacterial, such as triclosan, they reduce the number of bacteria on your skin. Good and bad. They don't completely eliminate it.
Okay.
There's been studies done. You become recolonized pretty quickly following washing with soap. So you're not completely destroying your ecosystem by just simply using soap.
All right. Let's go to Bill from Yarmouth, Massachusetts. Bill, welcome to On Point.
Hi. Thanks for having me on.
Sure.
I just wanted to add to the conversation that my wife and I have been making our own deodorant for about 2 years now, and that's a result of just being aware that the skin is the largest organ in the body,
mm-hmm.
and it absorbs quite a lot of chemicles.
We don't have a ton of time. I would love to know what the ingredients are, and how do you
cook
it?
Sure, very simple. It's baking soda,
yeah.
organic coconut oil,
mm-hmm.
tea tree oil, and arrowroot powder. And we use it, and we haven't had any type of BO in a very long time. It's just a very clean feeling, and you can just know that your body is absorbing organic ingredients
instead of manufactured
chemicals.
You just stir it cold, or do you cook it, or what?
Well, you stir it up in a bowl, and you get it into a paste, and you just smush it right into an empty container, and you just refill it as needed. It takes less than 5 minutes.
Interesting.
And you know what you're putting on your body. So it's really easy.
Thanks very much for calling, Bill. And Bob in Boston, welcome to On Point.
Hi.
Hi, Bob.
I just had one quick suggestion as to when to wash your children,
mm-hmm.
as a father of two. When they stink.
How's that working out?
pretty good. Sometimes they go, you know, 3 or 4 days without a bath. Sometimes they need it a little more than that, but...
Julia Scott, you started this conversation for us. How does that make sense to you?
I think to each his own and her own.
Yeah.
You know, I think, you know, honestly, it's very, very interesting to listen to all these callers because, you know, by far the most common discussion that my story has sparked is to wash or not to wash, right?
Mm-hmm.
But to me, the larger question has become, when we wash, what might our products be doing on a microbial level?
Mm-hmm.
You know, the fact of the matter is that we're all guinea pigs for just a vast array of products. We've never used so many soaps at the same time, and we've never tested what they do to our resident bacteria, good or bad. So one of the big revelations for me in the course of doing my research for the story was just realizing, you know, how little we know, not only about what lives in our skin at this point, but what all of the products that we're adding every day might be doing.
So the last thing I want to ask you, after you went through this month with no showers, when you finally got into a shower and you turned the handle and the water poured, did it just feel amazing? Did you miss it?
You know, it was practically orgasmic.
Yeah.
I was singing, I was dancing, I was doing karaoke. If I could have tap danced, I would have. It felt great. But there was an undercurrent of regret, because I did have a suspicion that I might be eradicating the billions of good bacteria that I had spent 28 days spraying on my skin.
The and beauty indeed, of the shower was somewhat ruined for you. Well, Julia Stone, you're a journalist whose story on cleanliness appeared in last Sunday's Times Magazine. Thanks so much for joining us, Julia.
My pleasure, John.
And Elizabeth Grice, research dermatologist at the University of Pennsylvania. Thank you also, Elizabeth Grice.
Thank you.
You can continue the conversation and get the On Point podcast at our website, onpointradio.org. And you can follow us on Twitter and find us on Facebook at On Point Radio. Coming up Monday, opera legend Jesse Norman and her new memoir of growing up black in the segregated South and taking on the world stage with her song. I'm John Donvan, in for Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.
On Point is a production of WBUR Boston and NPR.